ABC.
You've probably heard of a disease called endometriosis, and you probably might know someone who lives with it as well. Endometriosis affects around 1 in 9 people assigned female at birth, and on average it can take up to 7 to 10 years to diagnose. As a society, we know a lot more about endo today than what we did, say, 10 or 20 years ago, but there's still a lot to be done. A group of endo patients and advocates are calling for a change to the national guidelines, which have been put together by the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists. These guidelines are to ensure that surgeons operating on endometriosis patients have more specialised training. Professor Jason Abbott is a fellow of the college, and he led the working group which designed the guidelines. He's also Professor of Obstetrics and Gynaecology at the University of New South Wales. Let's start with the easy question first. What is endometriosis?
Good way to start, I think, Kathy. Endometriosis is a really common condition where tissue similar to the lining of the uterus grows outside of the uterus, and it can cause a whole variety of symptoms. But principally, it can cause pain, infertility, and then general symptoms as well. So often people present with things like headache, fatigue, bloating, and it has a really dramatic effect on people's lives. And about 11.4% of people in Australia are diagnosed with endometriosis by the age of 44. So it's incredibly common. 1 in 9 people will have endometriosis in Australia.
That would seem to suggest that if there's a lot of people who suffer from this condition, that it needs special treatment. Are there guidelines that govern the treatment of endometriosis?
Yes, so Australia has just published its first guideline on the treatment of endometriosis, and that was through the Royal Australian New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists, and we had some federal funding that allowed us to produce the guidelines, and they were published almost a year ago, in fact, today. So that's a really timely reminder that we've now got these guidelines in Australia. It's the first time that we've had them after all of the time that we've known about endometriosis, and they're really to help clinicians through the process of understanding what endometriosis is, how it presents, and the treatments that we have available today according to the best science. And importantly, I think, Kathy, one of the really critical things about the guidelines is they point to holes in the science as well. So we know where we need to fill those holes in future to improve the guidelines.
A group of patients and advocates are calling for a change to those guidelines, as new as they are, if they're only 12 months old. But they'd like to see mandatory specialised excision surgery for all doctors who are treating endometriosis patients. What's excision surgery?
So look, surgery in any form is just one of the treatments available for endometriosis. And it's where you're trying to get rid of those lesions that I mentioned earlier. So you're really getting them out of the pelvis in any way, shape or form. Excisional surgery is where you cut out those lesions and you can remove that in any number of ways using a variety of different techniques. But principally, we're going to be using, and it sounds terrible, I know, Kathy, but scissors and an electrical current to remove those lesions. And that's kind of one of the principles of surgery. And excisional surgery has been around for quite a long time in endometriosis. We've known about that, but it's just one of the techniques that is used to get rid of the endometriosis lesions.
How successful is that form of surgery?
So endometriosis surgery overall has a success rate of around about 70% in terms of getting any response to reduction in pain. And we know that not everyone who has surgery for endometriosis will have improvement in their pain symptoms in particular, or if they're having surgery for fertility, will have a change in their fertility profile. And it's used in both of those two different key areas.
There's also ablation surgery as well. What's that, and how is it different from excision?
Yeah, so ablation is kind of a blanket term for getting rid of the tissue, but not necessarily cutting it out. And again, you can still use those same old scissors and that electrical current that I mentioned earlier, but instead of cutting sort of a little circle around the tissue, what you do is you use the electrical current to vaporize that tissue. And an electrical current, just like anywhere else, creates heat, and that heat can destroy those lesions. And it's important to remember that we've compared using ablation and excision, and when they're done in expert hands, actually there's not a whole lot of difference between those two techniques.
Yet patients and advocates are calling for excision training to be mandatory for all, and you're saying that even though there's been a comparison of the two types of surgery, excision and ablation, that they can be equally successful. So why would they be calling for excision training to be mandatory for all?
Yeah, look, I think this is one of the pieces of misinformation, and I'll start by saying that bad surgery is always going to be bad no matter how it's done. It's very important that anyone doing surgery has good grounding and training in a variety of techniques, understands the process that they're treating, and then uses a technique that's going to provide outcomes that are successful and safe for their patients. I think one of the key points about excision versus ablation that seems to got to be misunderstood is that if you remove the lesions by cutting them out, then first of all, you can take a true diagnosis because we can look at that tissue under a microscope outside of the body. And then the second thing is that people are of the belief that if you just do the ablation then, and you know, you've kind of hit the nail on the head, that you're not getting it out of the body. But actually, that's not what the science tells us. And the caveat here I'm going to put in here, Kathy, is that the science isn't brilliant. I would love to say that we have 10 studies that all say this, but in actual fact, we've only got two. And that's part of the problem.
What type of surgery is a person most likely to receive if they go into the public health system?
So, Kathy, I think this is really important. Both in the public and the private system, we have both of the techniques that we've been discussing today available. And you can have good excisional surgery anywhere in the country. And there is a program around the country that's been established whereby we're training people in advanced surgery, but also through the Royal Australian New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists, we have a network of public hospitals around the country where there are specialists who are highly qualified in the area of surgery for endometriosis. And so they'll know both of those techniques. The key differences, I think, between the public and the private sector with regards to endometriosis are really the timeline that it takes. Unfortunately, in the public sector, it takes a much longer time to get in for surgery, and we're very acutely aware of that with the terrible COVID pandemic that has expanded surgical waiting lists even longer than they were before. And you don't get the choice of your surgeon necessarily either. We do know that there's some very well-trained surgeons. I was trained in the public sector in Australia and in the UK, and I was taught excisional surgery both in Australia and the UK, and that was a very, very, very long time ago too, Kathy.
So does that happen now, though? Are doctors trained in both excision and ablation, or just one or the other?
No, they tend to be trained in both, and that's because we know that it's horses for courses. There are times where you might use that vaporization technique for small, superficial, shallow lesions, and there's times where you'll cut it out. You know, as a preference, I will nearly always cut it out because I'm dealing with quite deep disease a lot of the time, but so too are the trainees in the public system that I am working with, and those people that I treat in the public sector will have that as well.
The patient and advocate group are calling for excision surgery to be the gold standard treatment in the guidelines. So should it be the gold standard, or why isn't it the gold standard? Why would they be calling for it?
Yeah, look, I think, again, it's a really good hook, isn't it, to say that that's the gold standard. But for a technique to be called the gold standard, there needs to be very clear, unequivocal evidence that it is superior to all other techniques.
And you don't have that at the moment.
That's exactly right. Unfortunately, it would be lovely if we could say that almost anything in endometriosis had a gold standard, but we simply don't have the scientific evidence to back all of that up. Guidelines are built on scientific evidence, Kathy.
And you've got really two important studies.
And we've got two studies, yeah. So we have to be a little bit cautious in what we say as well.
So in
because
in
both
the budget,
of those techniques can be helpful.
The Coalition announced in their 2022 budget, and I understand they're not in power now, but a record $58 million was announced under the National Action Plan for Endometriosis. What are you going to use that money for? Will it go towards more surgery, excision surgery for patients, or will it go towards more scientific study?
So the announcement by the Coalition pre-budget and clearly it's important to understand whether that's going to be upheld by the new Labor government as it comes through, has a number of key outputs, but surgical training is not in there. So, I think that we need to make that very clear. There has been an announcement that there will be further imaging studies with an MBS item number for MRI to look at improving diagnosis for people who might have endometriosis using that technology. There's also a range of different other interventions. Some of them are scientific, as you mentioned. So that will include a variety of different research projects and programs that haven't yet been fully funded, fully announced, because they're not quite clear on who's going to apply for those grants, and that's the way the government works. They'll announce some funding, people will apply for specific projects, and then there is some recommendations in the guidelines about what holes need to be filled. I think in this particular instance, though, Kathy, we also need to be aware that it might become very, very difficult to run a study where you're comparing excision versus ablation, when we already have quite a disparate view in what the outcomes are going to be. And I mentioned before, we'd had a couple of studies where it has been done in the past, but what you want to do is you want to be able to say to patients, if you want the very best quality study, that I don't get to choose as the surgeon which technique you have, and you don't get to choose as the patient which technique you have. You get allocated, and we don't actually tell you which of those techniques you get, and then we follow you up. So people then would need to commit to that type of study. And it's extraordinarily difficult to get people to do that, particularly if they've already got a bias.
What are your hopes for that funding that was announced by the Coalition to be held up under the new Albanese Labor government?
For me, what we want to be able to do is get better research so we can fill those holes, so we can be more equivocal. And that may mean in the future that we are able to do studies where we get superiority of one technique over another, of one drug over another. But importantly, nearly every person who has endometriosis says the same thing about their disease. They don't necessarily want to be treated at the end. They want to know what causes it at the beginning and how to cure it. And that may be what we need to do, investment more at the early stages of disease, not at these very late stages where surgery can be difficult, complex, and not without risk as well, Kathy.
An endometriosis diagnosis takes between 7 and 10 years. Is that part of, for some people, is that part of the problem that you're talking about, one of the many holes that you've got to fill?
Absolutely. You know, when we said at the top of this interview that there's 11.4% of the population who have endometriosis, so that's 830,000 Australians, and yet a lot of people still haven't heard endometriosis, but we know that in the last 5 years, that's changed significantly. And it's changed significantly because we've got a national action plan in this disease that was announced in 2018. That comes to its end in 2023. And we hope that there'll be another 5-year action plan out of that. Part of that action plan was to reduce the time to diagnosis. And some early evidence really indicates that we've started to knock a couple of years off it. And the latest scientific evidence from Australia says that the time to diagnosis is down to about 6.5 years.
I understand that that Coalition promise of $58 million, that part of that, $16.5 million, was to go towards establishing two new specialist endometriosis and pelvic pain clinics in each state and territory. Is that likely to happen now? And what would that look like here in Queensland?
That will provide some infrastructure for really key critical personnel to get things established. But with those kinds of numbers that we've been talking about, it's not going to be there for everybody. We are hoping that once the detail is announced, and certainly we're also hoping for the Labor to support this initiative, that in areas like Queensland, which is, a vast state, that there will be access for those who need it most. it's not going to be enough to cover everybody, but at least if we've got pathways and then recognise specialist referrals so that people know where to go if they're having ongoing issues with endometriosis, then they're going to get the care that they need. And importantly, we can link that into some of those research projects that we've been talking about so that we can then change the iteration of the guidelines once we have that scientific evidence. I'm all for change, but we have to have that scientific evidence to make sure that it's going to work and we are doing the very best for our patients. It is, I hate to say it, painfully slow, and I really do feel for everyone who wants a change. And, you know, we need a change. We've started the process. We are in such a much, much better place than we were. However, we do need to be cautious about just thinking about the language that's used and ensuring that we don't do ourselves harm by stopping procedures that do have a good basis for working, that are helpful and successful for a large number of people. And that's one thing that we definitely can't afford to do as a community.
Professor Abbott, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, Kathy. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Jason Abbott is a fellow of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists. He's also Professor of Obstetrics and Gynaecology at the University of New South Wales.
ABC.